Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. The club is online at commonwealthclub.org, as well as on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for tonight's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our topic for discussion and our distinguished speaker, Joe Simidian, Santa Clara County Supervisor. Supervisor Simidian was elected to the Santa Clara Board of Supervisors in 2012 and reelected in 2016. His career in public service includes stints as a member of the California State Senate and the California State Assembly and mayor of Palo Alto. He has served as an election observer in El Salvador and Bosnia and participated in refugee relief and resettlement efforts in Albania and Kosovo. He brings this political and public service background to our program today, which is entitled Listening to Donald Trump's America. Supervisor Simidian has noted that in the immediate aftermath of the election, some of us were inclined to dismiss Trump voters as racist, sexist, homophobic, misogynistic, xenophobic. Leave anything out? But he also asked, is it really fair to claim that 46% of the American electorate fits this profile? Mr. Smidia didn't believe so, but he did wonder what prompted a large proportion of the electorate to vote for President Trump. To get some answers, he traveled to three counties in three states, Robeson County, North Carolina, Cambria County, Pennsylvania, and Macomb County, Michigan. There, Supervisor Simidian had more than 100 conversations in places that historically had voted for Democrat candidates for president, but many of these voters flipped in 2016, voting for Republican Donald Trump. Supervisor Simidian spent a week in each place, talking with cops, teachers, librarians, labor leaders, business people, academics, and a host of others from both political parties. We're about to discuss what he learned about America beyond the Bay Area. Please join me in welcoming Supervisor Joe Simidian.
Thank you.
Now, Joe, before we get into specifics, you know, we've known each other a long time, usually with me asking the questions and you being the public figure. You must have wondered what it was like to be on the other side. Do you have any aspirations to be a reporter if this political stuff gets old?
What I discovered is that I cannot read my own handwriting. That is the takeaway from these 3 weeks of interviews.
Let me ask you about your approach. I mean, 100 people in 3 weeks is a lot of people to interview. Yeah. How did you find them and decide who to talk to, and what kind of responses did you get?
You know, some of it was very purposeful and some of it was very random. So before I went to Robeson County, North Carolina, or Cambria County, Pennsylvania, or Macomb County, Michigan, we would call, write, email, and ask local leaders in the community if they would make themselves available to chat with me, but also to help me find other folks who would be part of the conversation. And tried to work down from what I would call established networks to sort of less and less established folks in the community who were a friend of a friend of a friend or somebody I work with who feels this way. And for the most part, and I can also say with one notable exception, people were very responsive and very gracious and very willing to, I mean, they were hungry to be heard, frankly. So they were, you know, even there was, you're who, you're from where, you want to talk about what? I mean, we got a lot of that, which is why it turned out to be a little more labor-intensive than I had initially anticipated. But eventually, you know, once people were clear that I wasn't part of a Nigerian email scam, they were very amenable to talking.
Okay, Joe, you know how to see the next question. I have to ask you about who was that one exception?
The one exception was a Republican leader in Cambria County, Pennsylvania. And I had made a point of reaching out to leadership of both parties in all three counties and in the other two counties in both North Carolina and subsequently in Michigan. Folks were happy to meet with me, notwithstanding the party differences. So I met with the Republican County Chair in Robinson County, North Carolina. We met at, in fact, he asked, could he bring the rest of his executive committee with him? And so I said, sure, you know, bring it. And I had fried chicken at Candy Sue's with the Republican Central Committee in Robinson County, North Carolina. In Macomb County, Michigan, it was just me and the chairman of the Macomb County Republican Party in a an empty, deserted campaign headquarters with a 6'3" life-size cardboard cutout of Donald Trump. And I kept thinking, please, God, nobody have a cell phone camera anywhere. You know, I'm going to be. But in back to your question, in Pennsylvania, when I called and asked, my staff actually had reached out ahead of time and said, they're not going to talk to you. And I was sure if I just get on the phone and was gracious that, you know, they'd be. And I literally held the phone away from my ear. I mean, you think of that as a cliche or a movie device, but I it was that loud. And I said, well, you know, ma'am, may I ask why you don't want to meet with me? And she said, people in Silicon Valley haven't given a bleep about Western Pennsylvania in the last 50 years, and I have no reason to believe they do today. And she just put it right out there and had no interest. And I subsequently learned that that particular county was the home county for the Republican chairman for the state of Pennsylvania, and that word had gone out by email and social media, there's a Democrat coming from California. Don't talk to him. And the good news is that a bunch of people thought, well, that sounds fascinating, and reached out to me and said, hey, I'd like to talk to you when you come. So it worked out. But the Republican county chair in that one county just said, not interested. In the other two counties, they were, you know, among the best conversations I had.
I'll bet in some of those conversations, they were as puzzled as why California is as it is as you were about there.
Yeah, and this was a challenge in all the conversations because people would say, you know, I'd ask a question or two, and then they'd start to say, well, what do you think, or how is it? And I'd say, well, you know, I'm happy to share my point of view, but I really came to listen to you. So if we could sort of get through that piece of the conversation first. And I didn't, you know, I was there to listen. I wasn't there to debate, and I wasn't there to judge, and I wasn't there to score points in a rhetorical contest. So I tried as much as I could to put that aside, at least until the end of the conversation.
I'm definitely going to want to get into some of the specifics of each county because I've not only read your piece in Sunday's Insights section in the Chronicle, but also was fortunate enough you sent me a copy of your extended speech that you gave, and you have some really fascinating observations of distinctions yeah. among those counties. But let me ask you about the larger takeaway. I'm sure a lot of folks in the audience, as myself, wondered on November 8th, how I never saw this coming. Were there general takeaways where you saw common themes throughout the those three counties?
You know, these are always easier in the aftermath, but I was really struck by how deep the distaste for Hillary Clinton was and how widespread. And, you know, not everyone in the Bay Area was a fan. And certainly looking at the national polling data, we all knew that her, quote, unfavorables were high, although Donald Trump's were even higher. But I mean, John, everywhere I went, it was visceral and deep and wide. And they didn't like her. They didn't trust her. Some of it was about gender. That was very clear, but not all of it. And, you know, when I asked people, well, what's this about? Don't trust her. Why? Emails, Benghazi, the foundation. Emails, Benghazi, the foundation. Emails, Benghazi. I heard more about Benghazi in the first day of my first trip than I had heard about Benghazi in the year running up to the election here in California. I mean, the people were, and then, you know, just they didn't like her. They thought she was elitist. They thought she was condescending. A new phrase I hadn't heard before, one woman said, I thought she was snooty hooty, and I didn't exactly know what that meant, but I got a pretty good impression that it wasn't a good thing. And so they didn't like her. But putting that aside, the thing that all three of the places I visited had in common, and I didn't really know this before I went because they flipped. That was the thing that drew me. They had voted for Obama previously at least once, if not twice, and yet they were among the 6 to 10 million Americans who flipped and voted for President Trump. And what I discovered was they were all places of economic deprivation, and they were all places of long-standing economic deprivation. So if I were to say, you know, what was the takeaway, it was that the election wasn't really so much about a moment in time in 2016. It wasn't even just the lingering after effects of the 2008 recession. These are places that for 20, 30, or 40 years have felt like their quality of life is just less and less and less. And they see the system and politicians and Democrats as having talked a good game but not delivered. And after 40 years, they were out of time and out of patience. And Donald Trump arrived with just the right message at just the right time for folks who had run out of patience. So that was my takeaway.
Let's get into some of the specifics of the counties, because I found your observations to be fascinating. First of all, Robeson County, North Carolina. I was struck where you talked about the demographics there. 70% either African American, Latino, or Native American, and Trump won that county.
And Democrats outnumber Republicans in Robeson County, North Carolina, 5-1.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump won that county. And that's a county that had voted for Barack Obama not once but twice. That's a county that is probably the poorest or one of the poorest counties in the state of North Carolina. And yet with all of that, it went Trump. And in their case, they had tobacco, and now it's gone. And then they had textiles, and now they're gone. And again, you know, this is a place where people talk about NAFTA as if it was just yesterday. And they talk with quite a bit of authority about jobs going to China or Mexico or Brazil or the Caribbean Basin. They remember the exact date of that the Converse plant closed in 2001 and how many jobs there were on which shift. And, you know, someone who used to make $60,000, $65,000 a year with a high school education, which you could if you had some hustle and you worked hard at the textile plant, which was enough to support a family in a low-cost county in rural North Carolina. Those jobs are gone, and he's making $20,000, $25,000 a year now, driving a panel truck, refilling the vending machines, or food processing is big now. So you got a job. Imagine spending 8 hours a day pulling the guts out of chickens for half the wages you used to make 15 or 20 years ago. So people, you know, have been waiting a long time for the cavalry to come, and in their view, it hasn't come, and they just said, not doing that anymore.
But still, Joe, it seems almost impossible that it would overcome those demographics. I mean, on day one of his campaign, Donald Trump insults Latinos, Mexican-Americans, saying they're rapists, bringing drugs. Certainly with African-Americans, there were issues throughout the campaign. How did people reconcile their vote with the fact that he's insulting these?
Well, a couple things. One is, you know, in every case, in all three counties, I was looking for both what do they have in common, but what's unique to each case. So in Robeson County, North Carolina, there had been a hurricane, which meant there had been a flood, which meant that the folks who were in low-lying areas were displaced by the flood. Ask yourself, who are those folks? Not the prosperous, well-to-do folks. Those are lower-income folks who, having been wiped out of their homes a month before Election Day, had other things on their mind besides showing up at the polls. So that's a unique case. You know, there's a unique story in each one of these three counties, as I say. In Cambria County, Pennsylvania, the unique story was that's the home county for the Republican chairman of the state of Pennsylvania, and he's got some personal pride about what he does, and on and on. But back to Robeson County, North Carolina. So there's an emerging Latino population, but it's undocumented and unregistered. Okay. There's a significant African-American population that still votes Democratic, but that was not heavily motivated in this last election. The big chunk of voters there, probably 40%, 50%, Lumbee Indian tribe. It's not a federally recognized tribe, but it's a tribe that wants to be federally recognized, not terribly partisan and moving away from Democrats towards Republicans. So, you know, all of a sudden you unpack the numbers a little bit more and you realize that it's more complicated than you realized and that sort of making quick assumptions based on racial or ethnic demography is sometimes the path to a misperception.
Interesting. Cambria County, Pennsylvania. As you say, it's all about coal and steel there.
Yeah, and 93% white. Johnstown, for those of you who know that name, the place of the Johnstown flood, and a town full of what were once referred to as ethnics back in the day, and folks who, you know, what was fascinating there was Barack Obama won the county as recently as 2008, and yet by 2016, Hillary Clinton couldn't crack 30%. Donald Trump won with 67% of the vote in a place that just 8 years previously had voted for Barack Obama, the largest victory margin in that county's modern history for a presidential candidate. And, you know, Hillary talked about ending coal. Donald Trump said, you know, I'm going to bring back the coal jobs. I'm going to bring back the steel jobs. And when I asked one of the folks there, you know, people believe that? He said, well, sir, false hope's better than no hope at all. That was so. No, I mean, people, you know, people who are, I mean, this is in a place where, I mean, it's almost cliched. People in the Johnstown and in the larger county, both of these first two counties are about 135,000 people each. The picture of FDR, Kennedy, and the Pope on the wall. I mean, I know that sounds old school, but that's still a real thing. And those folks voted for Donald Trump this time. And they voted for Donald Trump because they gave up. And so, you know, as one fellow said, I just thought it was time to shake up the snow globe. You know, another guy said, look, we keep doing what we're doing. We're going to keep getting what we've got. And here again, you know, people who used to make a pretty good living with a modest education are making half of what they made a couple of decades ago. And they ran out of patience and they ran out of hope. And they figured, what do they got to lose?
I think there's nothing illustrates the diversity of Trump voters that you came across than Macomb County, Michigan. Of course, you know, GM, Ford, Chrysler among the top employers. You know, you would think it's an area in distress. But as you point out, during the Obama years, unemployment went there from 16% to 6%. You would think that would be Democratic territory.
Well, and I'm guessing that, you know, most of the folks who are listening right now remember that it was President Obama who engineered the rescue of the auto industry that were key to not just GM, Ford, and Chrysler, but to the jobs that GM, Ford, and Chrysler provided as, you know, the largest employers in the county. And yet, folks said, you know, nope. You know, Trump won by double-digit margin in that county. And, you know, it's a larger, more prosperous place. Macomb County, just outside Detroit, reminds me a lot of the suburban Bay Area. But, you know, I was talking with a woman who said, look, too many of my friends say, I'm working harder today and I'm making less money and my benefits suck and my pension went away. Why are we surprised that it was a change election? And, you know, why indeed? So even though folks there are perhaps not facing quite the tough times that they were in or are in the other two counties I visited. You know, it used to be if you worked in the plant, you could not only live a pretty good life, you could get a cabin up at the lake and buy a jet ski, and that's not happening anymore.
One of the observations that you made in reading the piece that you wrote is it's not like these things suddenly happened overnight and people who had voted Democratic would have a reason to reject the Democratic Party. First of all, these things have been going on in most of the cases, whether it's tobacco or the auto industry, for decades. And yet, all along the way, they've been voting for Democrat for president. And most of their local officials are Democrat. What was it about Trump where they found hope, whether it's real or false, where they didn't before?
Well, not only did most of the folks that I talked to or heard about couldn't get excited about Secretary Clinton. You know, in full disclosure, I supported Secretary Clinton in the primary and the general, wrote my check, helped organize a community event. So I'm hearing this over and over and over again and just, you know, sort of pinned back in my chair. But it wasn't just the candidate. It was also the National Democratic Party. In every community, in each of the three communities that I visited, folks would say, look, the National Party is not connected to who we are and what we're about in Robeson County or Cambria County or Macomb County. And, you know, the examples in Cambria County, Pennsylvania, the first day of deer hunting season is a school holiday. And to be proper about it, it's actually the first day of rifle deer hunting season. And I decided not to share that in Palo Alto we took ski week. That seemed bad. you know, it was. I thought, okay, there's. If you're a local Democratic office holder or aspirant in Cambria County, Pennsylvania, you seek out the NRA endorsement. You describe yourself as pro-life, and. You know, over and over again, I had people saying, Supervisor Simidian, you know, the National Party is just out of touch with folks here locally. And, you know, I talked to a group of young Democratic organizers in Macomb County, Michigan, and, you know, they would talk about, I think Tim Kaine came and spoke to a group there, and, you know, they were trying to drag some of the union guys to come to the hall to hear, and they were struggling. The guys didn't want to come. And they got a halfway decent crowd. And in the middle of his remarks, Kaine breaks into Spanish because he's bilingual. And, you know, one of the union guys turns and says, yeah, that's the language of the people who are trying to take our jobs. And then, you know, there's some talk about LGBTQ issues from Kaine. And again, you know, one of the union guys turns to the guy who's dragged him to the event and says, I don't care where some 8-year-old kid goes to the restroom. I care about putting a roof over my family's head and putting meals on the table. And so, you know, similar stories in all three counties. And one of the takeaways I took as, you know, I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I thought, all right, how does my party make this a conversation about how we can have this broader national vision and shared sense of commitment to opportunity for every American without abandoning our commitment to folks who have been marginalized or diminished in some way. And our party, my party, was viewed by a lot of the folks I spoke to, including people who had voted Democratic for years, as a party of narrow special interests, quote unquote. Now, when you're talking about women's rights, for example, it's like, really, that's a narrow special interest? It's 50%+ of the population. But that was the view that a lot of folks had. And as I say, they saw it as a binary choice. Are you a collection of special interests, or are you about all of us as Americans? And I think one of the great challenges we have is to listen, but also communicate in a way that suggests those two are not mutually exclusive. We can be about civil rights for people who've been marginalized or disenfranchised, as well as creating opportunity for all in some of these parts of the country that haven't been blessed the way we have in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley where I live.
In the days and weeks leading up to the election, the conventional wisdom was that, if anything, Trump's poll numbers may be a little bit inflated because he really didn't have what in politics you call the ground game. You know, he may have a lot of people who are supporting him who they may not get them to the polls, that Hillary and Clinton had invested a lot more money into it, had a much more sophisticated ground game. In those three counties, you found something very different.
Yeah, the Democratic Party operations in the places I went were uniformly described as sort of tired, out of touch, out of date, lacking in snap, crackle, and pop, lacking in technology. And on the Trump side, it wasn't so much that they had, you know, a 21st century technology, is that they had a passion and an enthusiasm that was simply unmatched on the Clinton side by folks who felt like they were voting for the lesser of two evils in most cases. The yard sign wars were particularly telling. I mean, if you talk to a professional consultant, particularly at the national level, they're going to tell you, look, presidential races are not won or lost based on yard signs. But if you talk to local folks, they're going to tell you, oh, no, you can tell what's going on in the community. But, and, you know, in North Carolina, the Democratic Party leadership said we couldn't get signs, and if we could get them, we couldn't give them away. And the Trump people not only had signs, they were making their own. Veterans for Trump, Christians for Trump, bales of hay painted with Trump signs, barn walls painted. And, you know, in Cambria County, I asked one woman who was a Trump supporter, I said, now, you know, what was the yard sign divide like? And she said, well, probably about 200-1 for Trump. And I said, you know, that sounds a little exaggerated. And she said, well, ask other people. So I did, and I asked a fella, and same day, and he said, no, I don't remember seeing a single sign for Hillary Clinton. And I said, you know, come on, really? There must have been at least one. And he thought really hard, scrunched up his forehead, and said, you're right. He said, but the only Hillary sign I saw was one that said Hillary for prison. That was the one Hillary Clinton sign he saw. So it was, you know, they, and again, in, you know, Pennsylvania, they were very, very crafty. They, people would call and ask for signs, and they'd say, well, we'll put you on a list, and then we'll have a day when you can come pick it up. Well, what they did then was call the press, turn it into a press event, and on a single day, this is in a county with only 135,000 people, they gave away 3,000 signs to 1,000 people who came to the headquarters in that single day. And, you know, huge buzz, tremendous enthusiasm, and just unmatched by the Clinton campaign in those three counties.
Well, we have a lot of good audience questions pouring in, so we're going to let all of you take over here. Here's a question, which I think is a very good one, and that's, were you able to ascertain where these voters got their news, their information about the candidates? Because one of the phenomenons that we've seen in this country in recent years is more and more people tend to go to news sources that validate their preconceptions, whether it's Fox or MSNBC. Was that a question that came up?
I didn't raise it, and benefit of hindsight, I wish I had, because it is a question I have been asked every time I have this conversation in the community. I will say two things that may seem a little contrary, but the first is I was surprised at how knowledgeable people were everywhere I went. I mean, with a level of knowledge and detail, you know, right down to the names of sort of second-tier administration officials that I couldn't have pulled out of a hat if my life depended on it. I mean, so people clearly were engaged and informed. On the other hand, the phenomenon of believing the sources that are consistent with your own point of view was front and center. In North Carolina, a fellow I was talking to suggested that I take a look on YouTube at something called The Continental Divide, which is a hour-long sermon by a minister with the Denton Bible Ministry that articulates in very clear language why, if you are an evangelical, you must vote for Donald Trump. And I thought, you know, I can do 5 or 10 minutes of that. And I watched the whole thing, and I'm a little embarrassed to tell you I watched it twice, actually, because it was just fascinating to see how that argument gets made and how people sort of come to those conclusions. So it, you know, it was clear to me that folks did have their own sources of news. But as I said, by the same token, I was surprised at how well-informed people were in a lot of places.
Speaking of which, question on how do you talk to Trump supporters who believe all of Donald Trump's lies? There are still people who believe, for example, that President Obama was born outside the United States.
I had surprisingly little of that, actually. I had, of all the conversations I had, and there were more than 100, as I say, I had one person who told me they were absolutely clear that President Obama was a Muslim. And I was curious, and so I asked, you know, he says he's Christian, what makes you think otherwise? And he said, you know, I look at what people do and not what they say, and based on that, I'm very clear that President Obama is a Muslim. And by the way, did I mention that Valerie Jarrett was born in Iran, which is true, by the way. But so you sort of see where that narrative was headed. That, you know, that being said, one of the things that I took away that for me was an important realization was I would say most of the people I talked to didn't believe everything Donald Trump said. Most of them, I mean, because an obvious question to me was, wait a minute, you're overwrought about these perceived shortcomings of Hillary Clinton, but you're prepared to look right by the conduct and comments of Donald Trump. What's that about? And the answer is that people who are desperate for economic security and the dignity and the hope that goes with it are willing to overlook an awful lot if someone like Donald Trump is prepared to make the promises he was prepared to make. So in a lot of cases, they weren't necessarily, I mean, they weren't pretending he was something he wasn't. They were just prepared to dismiss it. One fellow I talked to, I said, well, really, the evangelical community got behind Trump, notwithstanding the things that you heard in the tape. And the guy just looked at me and said, we're not voting for Sunday school teacher. You know, he was paraphrasing the Reverend Jerry Falwell Jr. But, you know, people's view was, you know, there was one of them said, look, maybe he could have said it better, but at least he said it. And, you know, and said it meant, you know, I'm going to bring the jobs back. So people were willing to overlook an awful lot. They weren't inclined. They didn't think he was a saint. The way I would put it, desperate people make desperate choices, and folks were pretty desperate in all three of the places I went. They were willing to overlook an awful lot.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
You know, I was mindful of that as I was going through the visits, but when I came back and sort of organized my notes and collated them, you know, what I realized was I had a stack this high about how people felt about Hillary Clinton, but a stack only that high about what I would have thought would have been some of the hot button issues. I had a stack that high about economic insecurity, jobs, welfare, and a stack, you know, that low on some of these other issues. So it really was about this sense of economic insecurity, the fact that it is longstanding, the fact that people in public office have not delivered. I got an earful about elected officials, and I mean, it was just, people were at a point where they said, and when I say longstanding, I just a little pop culture note here. I'm looking around to see the age of the folks in the room. How many of you remember a movie from 1977 with Paul Newman called Slapshot? Anybody remember that?
So hockey movie.
And, yeah, about a small town struggling minor league hockey franchise. This is 1977. It is set in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, the place where I visited. And in 1977, the characters are walking down the main drag in the first 5 minutes of the film, and one turns to the other and says, hey, did you hear the plant's closing? Really? Yeah, 10,000 people are going to be out of a job. 1983, there's another pop culture moment, All the Right Moves with Tom Cruise as a high school football player trying to get out of a small industrial town, guess where? Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And, you know, halfway through the movie, it's like, did you hear about the layoffs at the plant? 700 people are going to lose their job. And my point here is pop culture already knew this 4 decades ago. So if you live in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, you're wondering, you know, how long do we have to wait? What's it going to take for someone to say, all right, we not only know about it, we're going to do something about it. And, you know, in some places they say $700 billion in TARP funds, but we didn't see any of it here. Okay. You know, as I say, Trump arrived at the right moment with the right message, and that's why I think it's not just about 2016. It's not just about the lingering after effects of 2008. It's about decades of deprivation that have been, in the view of the folks I talked to, not just unresolved, but unheard by the political class and the establishment.
Joe, looking at this stack of questions, I think I can consolidate a number of them into one, and that is, if Bernie Sanders had gotten the nomination, would it have made a difference? Would he have been able to address some of these concerns that you were hearing?
You know, I heard from folks that almost anyone other than Hillary Clinton would have been successful in their counties. So there were some folks who were big Joe Biden fans because of Biden's ability to speak to these sort of working class issues in a way that they didn't feel Hillary Clinton had. There were other folks who thought Bernie would have won. There were more than a handful of people I met or people I met who had friends and family members who had been Bernie and then Trump voters. And to those of us in California, I think that seemed less likely and frankly sort of a, you know, a media creation. And it was real. There were people out there who and actually, and this was part of what surprised me. You know, I had some folks who said, well, wait a minute, why are you surprised? And I said, well, you know, I thought I'd explain it. They said, you're surprised that we voted for Obama and then voted for Trump. I said, yeah, I am. They said, you forget when we voted for Obama before, we voted for him against Hillary Clinton. You know, I mean, it's like, okay. And others would say, we voted for Obama because we thought he was the change. And 8 years later, nothing's changed. So we're doubling down on change. So to them, it was perfectly intellectually consistent that they voted for change with Barack Obama, didn't see it, came right back and doubled down on change with the guy who was really going to be the change agent, in their view.
Joe, why are we not seeing this phenomenon play out, at least in this scale, in parts of California that are certainly California has, if you factor in everything, one of the higher poverty rates in the nation. There's certainly pockets in the Central Valley and the foothills that are experiencing a lot of the same anxieties, economic and otherwise, that you're describing here. And yet the Republican registration continues to slip to where it's now roughly 1 in 4 California registered voters are Republican. Why aren't we seeing it here?
I think we are seeing it here, and but I think it is to some extent masked by the fact that we have such strong progressive values in coastal California where the population is. So I think that tends to mask or overshadow what's happening in other parts of the state, including the Central Valley. I also think that part of the Trump phenomenon, and you asked about this earlier, is that folks who had not previously been in the system came out of the woodwork to vote for Donald Trump. So, you know, I talked with a very bright entrepreneurial young businessman and who had been a Trump supporter, and I asked him now, you know, who'd you vote for in 08 and 12? He said, didn't vote. And I said, what? He said, didn't vote because I didn't think it'd make a difference. I voted this time because I thought it would make a difference. So he, you know, he was among the group of folks who had sort of disconnected themselves from the political arena for a long time, but stepped back in when someone came along who we thought would shake up the system. Same story, you know, the Republican county chairman in Michigan that I talked to said, you know, he had 2 or 3 favorite bars and restaurants, and all of a sudden he noticed that the waiters and waitresses, you know, were talking about Trump that these were not political people. And they were people making a fairly modest wage as a waiter or waitress. And he said, you know, I realized something was going on when people who historically had never paid any attention or had much interest in politics were getting excited about our candidate. So
I'm interested in, since you've done all this research and running a theory by you that I've had about the Trump phenomenon. And that's that in America, people have lost respect, lost regard for so many institutions. Certainly the media is one of them, Congress, government. You look at like NATO, where throughout, you know, most of our lives, if you're in my generation, you've seen that as really, you know, the bedrock of U.S. security. But you could just go right down the line, and Trump, including the judiciary, and Trump showed little regard for any of them. And I have a sense that where we would take a lot of things seriously, like, oh my God, we can't withdraw from NATO, or we have to, you know, really think about the consequences of our relations with Mexico, or even trusting the media, that because the public had this disillusionment, that they really didn't take it as seriously, the potential downfalls as maybe they could have.
I think, you know, one of the fascinating things about having these conversations, taking 3 trips like these, is that there are a lot of things that become, it's clear how complicated they are, how multi-layered they are. And then there are some other things that you realize are just simpler than you thought they were and that you don't need to overcomplicate. And I think what I would say to your theory is, what part of it's not working for me do you people not get? period, full stop, end of sentence, and over and over and over again. And so, you know, if it isn't working for you, and it hasn't been working for you for all of your adult life, and somebody comes along and says, I'm going to give the system a good swift kick in the pants, you know, the folks I'm talking to aren't saying, oh, don't do that, that's not nice. They're saying, you know what, the system needs a good swift kick in the pants. And, you know, when Trump said, what have you got to lose, largely directed at African-American voters, I don't think African-American voters particularly thought that was persuasive. But boy, I think that's where a lot of the American public was, which is, what have we got to lose? Not a damn thing. And so, you know, I did my visits from late February into early June. So that's how much tumult there was. You know, the intervening months have been even more tumultuous. But I got to tell you, the people I talked to were not upset. They weren't disappointed. Every fresh outrage, as we might see it here in the Bay Area, was viewed as another poke in the snout of the establishment, and good for him. And so it's, you know, every time you recoil, there are 20 people I talked to said, yeah, hit him again, harder.
And there was no disappointment that he had not delivered on his promise. No one was saying, where's the wall? How come Muslims are still getting off the planes? Or
people I talked to understood that you people in the establishment were going to make it hard for him to do that. And they were, you know, getting fresh proof of that with every passing day.
Interesting. And let's go to another audience question. Do you view Trump's election as an anomaly fueled by a celebrity and a fractured Republican field and a weak Democratic nominee? Will things return to quote-unquote normal after Trump, or is there a fundamental change that's occurring here?
And the answer is yes to both. you know, for those of you who are number crunchers or political junkies, many of you will know that Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, part of the so-called blue wall that Democrats thought they could rely on for the last quarter of a century. I mean, six straight elections, the Democratic nominee has taken those three states. That means the Democratic nominee has been 18-0 in those three states over the last quarter of a century. This time around, our Democratic nominee went 0-3. Now, you know, I can't even begin to fathom how hard it is to put together a presidential campaign. I am not in a position to second guess. But when you go 0-3 in states that have gone 18-0 for the last quarter of a century, somebody missed something. And on the Trump side, somebody saw something. They saw an opportunity and they capitalized on it. So was it a fluke? Maybe. Was it a perfect storm? Maybe. All of that being said, when 6 to 10 million Americans who voted for Barack Obama vote for Donald Trump, something's going on, and I think that something is important. What is it that has so disillusioned 6 to 10 million Obama voters that they would vote for Donald Trump? I mean, that's 10 to 15% of Trump's total vote. If even half of those folks had stayed with the Democratic nominee, we wouldn't all be sitting here having this conversation. So was it a bit of a fluke? Was it a perfect storm? Yes, but let's not use that as an excuse to avoid what I think is the hard conversation we need to be having about how is the system failing vast swaths of this country and what are we going to do about it, both as a national imperative and as a political imperative, because I think there are consequences to pretending that it's not real and not significant.
What kind of a factor was the religious right in those three counties?
You know, social issues / religious right was not as dominant as I thought it was. You know, it's there, but then, you know, it's been there in the past. What was interesting to me, and certainly in North Carolina, where there's a strong evangelical presence, there was, you know, it was more strongly felt. It was something I could understand playing a more significant role than we might expect in our area. But what was more interesting to me was that the so-called social issues, choice, marriage equality, transgender rights, were referenced more often than not as indicators of how out of touch the national party was with local voters. So issues that we in this room might think of as central were viewed as tangential. Again, they weren't bread and butter issues. I used the example of the bathroom bill controversy, which to a lot of the folks I talked to seemed secondary given their economic hardship. And you know, the National Democratic Party was viewed as urban and elitist and out of touch, and the social issues debate was sort of just another way, whether it was guns in Pennsylvania or the bathroom bill, which was a controversy in North Carolina when I was there. It was just another way of saying, you all aren't, your party's not in touch with small town, rural American values that folks like us have.
Joe, I reviewed Hillary's new book, What Happened, without a question mark, just What Happened, for the Chronicle. And I was interested, on page two, she comes out and says, I couldn't get the job done, and I'll have to live that with that the rest of my life, really accepting responsibility. And then the next 498 or so pages, she finds a lot of blame to apportion. I mean, you know, we have Bernie Sanders, the double standard for women in politics, Russian interference, a new voter ID law in Wisconsin, the media, the list goes on. But most notably, she thinks the thing that really turned the tables was that October 28th James Comey announcement that the investigation was being reopened. Did you run into anyone who said that was the clincher for me?
I didn't run into anyone who said that particular incident was the clincher. I did, as I mentioned, run into lots of folks who said, emails Benghazi Foundation, emails Benghazi Foundation, emails Benghazi Foundation. So, you know, it was very clear that that message had been pounded home with great effect. And it was, and again, you know, if you ask yourself, did American voters choose Donald Trump rather than Hillary Clinton because of emails? I would say that wasn't borne out by my experience. If you ask, however, were emails Benghazi and Foundation sort of part of a larger narrative about this is not a person to be trusted, and did that take hold? Absolutely. So, you know, whether you want to, when a race is this close, when somebody wins the national popular vote and loses the presidency in a sort of a fluky slash perfect storm kind of way, it's easy enough and to some extent accurate to say, well, but for this or but for that, you know, I would have had a different outcome. Fair enough. But the real question to me is, how did it ever get that close given this candidate who I considered and consider wholly unfit to be president of the United States? Whether you agree with me or not, that's my point is, how did it ever get to be that close? How did it get to be so close that you could say, well, any one of these things might have turned the tide? And so I think, you know, that's the difficulty for a campaign or a candidate. They'll second guess themselves on everything for the rest of their lives because it but for this, that, or the other, it might have gone a different way.
You mentioned the widespread perception that you found that Democrats were captive of special interests.
Yeah.
But here's a more general question from an audience member or observation that the Democratic Party seems to have moved substantially to the left and is now refusing to work with Donald Trump on anything at all. Do you think that's a winning long-term strategy?
I have a very, well, so there is a debate in the Democratic Party right now between those who say we should move to the center because that's how we'll win the Midwest, and those who say we should move to the left because that's where the energy in the party is. And I think that debate misses the point altogether. I think it is the wrong debate to be having. The folks I was talking to don't really think left-right. What they think is, I need a job that pays a decent wage and allows me to put a roof over my head, put food on the table, and give my kids a shot. So what I would say is the Democratic Party needs to ask, how can we get the job done for these people, whoever they are, wherever they are? I mean, two-thirds of the country does not have a bachelor's degree. So really, we're just going to say, I mean, you know, again, you know, I live in Palo Alto where 80% of the population has a bachelor's degree. Here in San Francisco, it's 50%+. You go to Robeson County, it's 13%. You go to Cambria County, it's 19%. You go to Macomb County, it's 22%, 23%. Now, are we just going to leave those folks out of the economy? Because if so, you're going to have two-thirds of the American public that is left behind and left out. And I would argue that's not only morally wrong, that it's dangerous. And not only is it morally wrong and dangerous, it's expensive because we're a donor state. We send money to the federal government and get less back because the systemic failures of our system mean we've got to subsidize all these folks who are not making it. So, you know, I think it's both wrong, dangerous, and expensive to simply look the other way when you get two-thirds of the population that isn't positioned to be successful in our 21st century economy. So, I mean, that's another conversation for another panel, I'm sure, but that's real and it's pervasive and we've got to come to grips with that.
Well, Joe, do you think that the Democratic Party does have solutions, does have ideas to address these issues? The problem was just the message and the messenger, or do Democrats need to rethink not just how to talk to people in these areas, but how to address their concerns?
Well, I do think both the party, I think the party has real solutions, and I think part of it is, and I don't want to use glib political phrases like messaging. What I discovered was people whose views and values I do not share were gracious, welcoming, and hungry to be heard. I'm not talking about the haters. I'm not talking about the people that, you know, we all, I'm talking about 6 to 10 million folks who voted for Barack Obama who flipped and voted for Trump. So what I would say is that it starts with listening and understanding. And I'm not trying to be warm and fuzzy here. Understanding alone is not going to get the job done. But without at least some understanding, we're never going to have an ability to get the job done. And then, do I think it's hard? Yeah, we're talking about remaking a 21st century economy so that these folks can have a role to play. We're never going to compete, nor should we try, with pennies an hour developing nations across the globe. But we got to find a way to create upskilled manufacturing jobs. Then we got to find a way to train and educate people to do those jobs. And it's a dramatic shift in the way we've thought. And again, the point all these people were making is, you've had 40 years to figure it out. How much longer do you expect me to hold on? And, you know, we can all say, well, they should help themselves or they should move. But, you know, I don't think either party has figured it out entirely yet. But I think, and here my partisanship will show, I thought the Democratic Party, and I still think the Democratic Party, is the party of working people. I mean, my grandparents on my father's side came over on the boat. They're Armenian. They fled the genocide. They came to New York City. They lived in a two-room tailor shop. They pulled the curtain down. They pulled the cot out, and Dad and Grandpa slept in the front. Grandma and Aunt Virginia slept in the back. And then my father got to go to college on the GI Bill, and he got to be a teacher. And then that meant I could go to great schools here in California and have access to fine universities, and I could end up being a state senator or a county supervisor. And I tell that story not because it's special or unique, but because it's not. It's a very common story for generations of Americans. And now we've got generations of Americans who are thinking that's not going to be their story. And we better figure out how to rewrite that story.
Here's one of my favorite audience questions. Simply, why did you do this, Senator Sumita? I mean, it's certainly not uncommon for a candidate to go on a listening tour before an election, to talk to potential voters, but after an election, it's very unusual.
Well,
you're not running 2020 area.
I want to be very clear. I'm not planning to run for office in Robeson County, North Carolina, or Cambria County, or Macomb County. I really thought something important just happened, and I thought that it was important for my work to understand it. I mean, at the risk of stating the obvious, we're all living with the consequences of what just happened. You know, for years, as someone in the public and political process, I've heard people say, oh, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two parties, or it doesn't matter who we elect. Really? I went because I thought I could listen, learn, and understand something that would be important to how I did my work. And I got what I wanted from that. If anything, I would say I underestimated the extent to which people would be interested. I didn't do it because I thought I would come back and have something to share. I did it because I thought I would come back and understand better what was happening in the country and how that should inform my work.
I think the volume and quality of questions that we're getting from the audience tonight shows there's certainly a great deal of interest here. Here's an audience question of, to what extent, if at all, do you think people voted for Trump simply because they were not prepared for a woman president?
Gender was more of an issue than I expected, and some of you will say, how could you be that naive? I grew up with a single mom until I was 14. She worked in a male-dominated field. At one point, she actually was a school teacher in one of the last school districts in Massachusetts that had separate salary schedules for men and women, and you can guess which way that worked. I never asked about it. I might have once or twice later, but I mean, I just sort of waited for people to talk, and it came up repeatedly. And among the things I took away were, first of all, gender was a big issue among women voters, which really was startling to me, but I heard that everywhere I went. And it was, in some cases, just, you know, not sure I'm ready for a woman to be president of the United States. Okay. Other places, it was, not sure I think a woman should be commander in chief. Some places it was, well, you know, she only stayed with Bill to advance her political career. Other places it was, working class guys in the mills and the mines aren't really used to taking orders from a woman. And in the evangelical South, there were folks who said, my Bible tells me this isn't the proper role for women. So I heard a wide range of sort of backstories, but gender was clearly more of an issue than I would have expected, again, as a Californian and as a Bay Area or Silicon Valley resident.
Although if you look at the national returns, I was certainly surprised and struck by how well Trump did with women nationally.
Yeah, and
it was
again,
not the gender gap that was expected by any means.
Yeah, and again, it came in different packages depending on where I was and who I was talking to. But the most striking thing was the number of women who said, "Well, you know, I got to tell you, that was an issue for me, or that was an issue for my mom, or my sister had a problem with that, or it was." You know, it's the kind of thing that people in California may think but don't say. But in the places I went, people just said it. There was no reticence about it.
Okay, we have another audience question here who member believes the division in the U.S. is a chief concern. The election results and lack of belief and along with this protests and riots in the U.S. makes it feel like a scary country. Do you see any hope from your visit for finding common ground in this country?
I do. I want to be very clear about this. I hope people understand that I am the messenger here. I am I feel strongly that it is important for those of us who have the views and values that I hold that are antithetical to the current administration to stand up and speak out and push back. That being said, I think we can do that even as, and in fact, I would say it's particularly important as we do that, that we listen to other points of view, particularly the folks that we know were sharing, we thought, the same views and values as recently as 4 or 8 years ago. And I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. In fact, I think the two are essential. I think we got to listen, we got to understand, we got to acknowledge legitimate concerns where they exist. And then ask ourselves, all right, is there a way for us to move forward together on some of these issues, even as we say, absolutely not, cannot go there, this, that, or the other is wrong? And that's tough to do. But again, the people I talk to, I mean, they knew who I was. You know, they've got Google in all of these places, right? I mean, people had spent, in some cases, a surprising amount of time getting to know who I was and knew more about me when I walked in the room than I did about them. And yet they were, as I said, they were hungry to be heard. And that should tell us that there's an opportunity for a conversation with some of the folks we're talking about. Not all. I mean, I think it's not surprising that, you know, when we look at favorable ratings or approval ratings for the president, that it sort of drops down to sub 40. This is a president who got 46% of the electorate. It drops down to sub 40 into the sort of mid-30s, and I think it probably stays there. And I'm not suggesting that we're going to be able to talk to that hardcore 35%. But the 10% that is having second thoughts based on what they see and hear today, I think those are folks we can and should be talking to.
I can only imagine them Googling you, Joe, and saying, oh, he's the California senator who started this trend that I can't talk on my cell phone in the car or text, you know, taking away my freedom. Next he's going to go after my guns.
And in Pennsylvania, this is a state that had a helmet law for motorcyclists and repealed it. Yeah, see, you all think, oh, my God, how could they do such a thing? They're like, no, that was a bad idea. That was an imposition on my personal freedom, and we rolled it back. It's just a very, very different take. And, again, all three of these counties are places where Democrats are elected to local office. But, you know, their notion of what a Democrat is and the National Party's notion or the Bay Area's notion of what a Democrat is, very different things.
How much did Obamacare come up?
Not much. It came up a handful of times from people who sort of were very thoughtful and, you know, opinionated about why it hadn't worked for them either individually or in their business. But it was not a recurring theme. Again, I noticed that as I went through the conversation. I mean, just as an example, Benghazi came up at least 20 times more often than Obamacare. I'm not being hyperbolic. I mean, literally 20 times more than Obamacare.
That suggests to me Fox News was a source of information.
There you go.
We have a number of questions asking you to forecast 2020 and Donald Trump's chances of getting elected and whether you think the people who voted for him that you encountered are likely to vote for him again.
I think the people I encountered who had been Obama voters but who gave up and felt they were desperate and going to make the desperate choice and voted for Trump are open to voting for the right Democratic candidate for president of the United States. Who she or he might be, I don't know. But I think if we get through 4 years of this administration, the folks I talk to are going to say, I'm not seeing any results, didn't deliver, I need, this is just chaos without a deliverable, and that the right Democratic candidate can and would be Donald Trump for this 6 to 10 million people that was a subset that I talked to.
There's such a tug of war going on within the White House now, even after Steve Bannon's departure, between the nationalists and the more mainstream Republicans. Did you get the sense that most of those you were talking to were more on the Bannon side of things?
Again, the folks I was talking to, they aren't ideological. They don't have a world view of White House politics. Their view is, you know, what's in it for me? I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, it's like, you know, look, this is my president. I want to know what my president's going to deliver for me and my family. And after that, the rest is just noise to them.
Joe, final question. You've been in the legislature and also a local official. What is personally did you take away from this in terms of, is it instructed you into how you would approach issues or do your job here in the Bay Area?
I had a very poignant conversation with a fellow who was late middle age, used to work in the textile mills as an administrator. And in the South, some of you know, they'll call you by your first name, but put Mr. or Ms. in front of it. So he said, Mr. Joseph, I make 45%. My earning capacity is 45% of what it was in 2001. Now, he knew precisely 45%, not roughly half. And he knew precisely what year, 2001. And he didn't say it with any bitterness or anger or ill will. He said it with resignation. And as we talked, what I realized is it's not just about the loss of income. It's about the loss of dignity and hope that goes with that loss of income. And so I am probably more mindful today of the fact that, it's a matter of dollars and cents, but it's also a matter of dignity and hope. And when two-thirds of the country is at risk of losing their dignity and hope, we are in a very, very scary place.
I will let that be the last word, and please join me in thanking Supervisor Joe Simedian.
Thanks.
I think you might have a vote here for 2020. I also want to thank our audience both here, and very much thank you for your great questions, and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm John Diaz, the San Francisco Chronicle. And with that, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you. Thanks, John.
So that's fantastic.
Thank you.